Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 4th of July, these are our main stories. The White House has insisted that President Biden is pressing ahead with his election campaign after a report suggested he was weighing up whether to continue. Hurricane Beryl has brought powerful winds and torrential rain as it roars along the south of Jamaica. And a senior commander of the Lebanese armed movement Hezbollah has been killed in an Israeli airstrike. Also in this podcast.
It's a complex scene. We have a large animal, in this case a pig, and then you have human-like figures that are playing with it.
Scientists believe that a 51,000-year-old painting found in a cave in Indonesia is the world's oldest example of figurative art. The US President Joe Biden is under mounting scrutiny following his stumbling performance in last week's televised debate with Donald Trump. Another White House has been forced to deny a report in the New York Times suggesting that Joe Biden was weighing up whether to continue in November's presidential race. Addressing the question during a media briefing, the White House spokeswoman, Karine Jean-Pierre, dismissed speculation that Mr. Biden was considering ending his bid for a second term.
The president is clear-eyed, and he is staying in the race. I don't have anything else beyond that. He's staying in the race. That is what the president has promised to do. That is what he wants to continue to work on the successes that he's had. His record is unprecedented record. And that is what the president is focused on, continuing to deliver for the American people. And he looks forward to doing that.
Well, I spoke to our U.S. correspondent Peter Bowes on Wednesday evening and began by asking him if that White House comment draws a line under the matter.
No, in a word, it doesn't. There is, Jackie, a head of steam swirling around this story that I don't think has reached its peak yet. The words in Washington that we're hearing a lot repeatedly over the last few days are panic mode, to describe how many Democrats are feeling. And there's a lot happening. As we speak, Democratic governors are arriving at the White House for a meeting with the president. If they have concerns, this will be their opportunity to confront Mr. Biden with them. There is reportedly a draft letter circulating, perhaps more than one letter amongst House Democrats, that may call for the president to quit the campaign over the next day or two. Two congressmen have now openly called for Mr. Biden to pull out. The New York Times is reporting that the Democratic Party donor Reed Hastings, who's a co-founder of Netflix, has called for Mr. Biden to step down. But as we have just heard from the White House, they're saying it's not his intention. In fact, the Biden campaign has just, in the last few minutes, sent out a message from the president via text and email to his supporters. It's a fundraising message, but it says, "Folks, let me be clear. I'm running. I'm the Democratic Party's nominee. No one is pushing me out. I'm not leaving. I'm in this race to the end, and we are going to win the election."
So he's pretty emphatic. If he were to change his mind, as you say, the pressure is still swirling around. Is it too late now for the Democrats to choose another candidate, even if they want to?
It's very late in the election cycle, but technically not too late, because the candidates for both parties are not confirmed until they go through the formal process of selection at the party conventions, which are coming up. The Democrats meet next month. What it would take, though, is for Joe Biden himself to stand down. If he is unwilling to do that, it would be extremely difficult, pretty much impossible, for the party to oust him. Now, not to get too technical, but if he were to say that he is going to go, he would release his delegates, those delegates that have already pledged support through the primary election process, and they would have an open convention. And the race would then be on to quickly find a new candidate. And currently, the Vice President, Kamala Harris, is the favourite to fulfil that role.
And meanwhile, how is all of this affecting polling?
Well, since the debate last week, which really started all of this with Joe Biden's poor performance, Donald Trump has increased his lead over Mr. Biden. There has been a marked effect. Different polls suggest that the former president is between 3 and 6 points ahead of Joe Biden now. And perhaps the most worrying of all for the Democrats, about three quarters of voters, 70-75%, according to the polls, view Mr. Biden as simply too old for the job.
That was Peter Bowes. Well, David Walters is a former Democratic governor of Oklahoma. He's now one of only 45 people to sit on the executive of the Democrat National Committee. Paul Henley asked him about his experience of seeing the debate. Was he watching through his fingers?
And several people in the room, we had some friends with us, and we were looking through our fingers, and just painful. We'd have to stand up and walk out of the room. It was a shocking and heartbreaking display that kind of took us all by surprise.
So the media reaction describing it as a car crash was not overblown?
No, not at all. It was, all of us have watched the president carefully because he obviously is aging, but we had no clue that being that well prepared for a debate would result in such a calamitous performance. So it was really most unfortunate.
And how has the president's damage limitation strategy gone?
I think they're doing the best they can. I mean, they're trying to have what the British would call a stiff upper lip, but I have been involved in the briefing for the DNC members, which had about 200 folks on the line last Saturday. And while they mentioned the debate and they put it in the context of, a bad performance and one debate and 90 minutes shouldn't define his administration, et cetera, all of these terms. But it was just, in many cases, I think it's a little bit too much rah-rah. I think there needs to be a little bit more appreciation for just how damaging and how bad this is, and kind of an open discussion of the alternatives.
Well, I've heard several Democrats saying there is no coming back from this. Would you concur?
It's hard to imagine how the president could recover from the decline in the polls. I mean, he was behind in all the key swing states going into the debate, and now he's is in a deeper deficit in those same swing states, and now we are on the verge of losing New Mexico, Virginia, and New Hampshire, which are blue states. And so, it looks like on paper, our campaigns go on forever, so 4 months seems like a short time. It looks like on paper that it is almost impossible to recover from what today would be an electoral college landslide.
David Walters, who's a member of the executive of the Democratic National Committee. Now, as we record this podcast, Hurricane Beryl is battering southern Jamaica with sustained winds of up to 230 kilometres an hour. There are reports of power cuts in many places, including the capital, Kingston. The Category 4 storm is already causing dangerous winds and a sea surge. The Jamaican Prime Minister, Andrew Holness, has declared a 12-hour daytime curfew across the island. The hurricane caused extensive damage on other Caribbean islands. 7 people are known to have died so far. Paul Henley spoke to the Minister of Local Government in Jamaica, Desmond McKenzie, and asked him what the latest news was.
Sections of the island has begun to feel the effects of it. There have been rainfall as I speak, gusty winds. We have had falling trees in some areas. We have had roads which have become impassable, the loss of power in some areas. So we are beginning to feel the heat of the hurricane.
And how are you preparing local people?
We did our mitigation exercise over a week ago. We have been advising people. We have been cleaning our drains, cutting down trees, and we have had a robust public education program sensitizing Jamaicans, especially persons who live in communities which are prone to flooding. We have over some 800 shelters across the country, and almost 80% of the shelters have been activated. We put the systems in place. Jamaicans were advised early, and Jamaicans were aware of the danger.
Presumably, as usually happens, it's the poorer communities who are most at risk, the flimsiest buildings and so on.
That is so, but one good thing that we have seen in the country, we have learned from Hurricane Gilbert, which struck us in 1988, the importance of solid buildings.
And do you think Jamaicans sort of accept hurricanes as a more frequent feature of life these days?
We are prone to this, and we are becoming more sophisticated in terms of how our citizens are educated and the role and the importance of being conscious and aware of where we are located as a country.
But it's becoming increasingly clear, isn't it, that climate change is driving an increase in these extreme events. Does that make the population of Jamaica more aware of stopping climate change, taking measures themselves? Does it make you as a government more determined?
Yes, it does. And we have been taking steps to minimize the effects of climate change. But, you know, the reality is that the great countries in the world who are exporting climate change to small developing states like Jamaica. In our region, we do not possess some of what is required to export our climate change. You know, we are playing our part.
Meanwhile, what's the mood on the island tonight? It must be tense.
Well, it is very tense. We will not know until sometime tomorrow. The government will respond. One of the good things about it is that this administration of Prime Minister Andrew Holness have put in place the necessary security for the country in terms of financing. We have had insurance bonds that will ensure that the country will be able to respond to any infrastructure damage that has been created. I want to say to the Jamaican population in your part of the world that we are hanging on and we are asking them to remember us in their prayers.
That was the Minister of Local Government in Jamaica, Desmond McKenzie. The hurricane has already caused extensive damage on other Caribbean islands. One of the most senior commanders of the Lebanese armed group Hezbollah has been killed in an Israeli airstrike. Reports say the man, who has been named as Mohammed Nima Nasser, died when his car was hit near the southern city of Tyre. The killing is the latest in a string of Israeli assassinations of Hezbollah commanders in Lebanon. Our correspondent Hugo Bachega is in Beirut.
Israeli military said he was the commander of the Aziz unit, which was responsible, they say, for attacks from southwestern Lebanon against Israel. And they said that this commander was involved in a number of attacks. So a high-profile Hezbollah figure. And again, I think what's significant here is that he's the second senior Hezbollah commander who's been killed by Israel here in Lebanon in less than a month. So this campaign of targeted killings by the Israeli military continues as this violence between Hezbollah and Israel continues as well.
And previous killings of Hezbollah fighters, senior Hezbollah figures, have elicited a response from Hezbollah. So what's expected?
This response, or at least part of it, has already happened because just hours ago, Hezbollah said it had launched 100 rockets at Israeli military sites in northern Israel. There were no reports of casualties, but this is the new routine here. We've seen that this is what's become the reality along the border. Those attacks, those counterattacks, some days are more violent, some days are quieter. Both sides continue to indicate that they want to avoid a major confrontation, but obviously there's always the fear of miscalculation here.
You've talked about a routine now of attack and counterattack. Just how serious is this situation between Israel and Hezbollah?
So Hezbollah is saying that what they're doing here is in support for Palestinians in Gaza. And they say that any ceasefire in Gaza will be observed here in Lebanon. And we know that talks for a deal between Israel and Hamas are stalled. So these attacks have continued. There has been an escalation of tensions in the last month or so. And the rhetoric has also escalated, especially from Israeli leaders. They say that this situation is unsustainable, that no country would accept being on the receiving end of missiles and rockets almost every day, and that they want to restore security in the northern part of the country to allow the return of tens of thousands of people who've been displaced. And they say that if diplomacy fails, they will use military force to change the situation. And I think people here in Lebanon still remember what happened in 2006, the last time there was a war between Hezbollah and Israel, and they fear we could end up seeing even more destruction.
That was Hugo Bachega in Beirut. A new study has found that when trotting, hippos can briefly become airborne. Researchers say that when moving fast, the animal's feet leave the ground for up to a third of a second at a time. Camilla Mills reports.
By contrast to hippos, elephants can only walk, and all four feet never leave the ground simultaneously. The findings from Britain's Royal Veterinary College suggest hippos are able to push the limits of what giant land animals can do. They are among the largest land creatures and can often weigh more than 2 tons. The lead author of the study said part of the reason so little research has been done into hippos is because they tend to stick to the water and are also very dangerous.
Camilla Mills. Still to come.
When he put the afterburners on, there was only ever going to be one winner. Even his opponents were happy to cheer him on.
A cycling record broken by the British sprint champion, Mark Cavendish. Reports from Belarus say a leading opposition figure who stood for the country's presidency has been released from prison. He joins hundreds of other prisoners released to mark the country's Independence Day celebrations. But human rights groups say Belarus still has more than 1,400 political prisoners behind bars. Our East Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford has been following the story.
For now, we don't know a huge amount because whenever a political prisoner is released in Belarus, those who know their names keep them quiet for their own safety for some time. Often these people, when they get out of prison, finally flee the country and they want to be able to do that safely. So for now, we know the name of one person for sure. His name is Grigory Kostusyov. He was a presidential election candidate back in 2010, but he was arrested in 2021. He was sentenced after that to 10 years in prison as part of what became known as the coup plot, allegations that he and other opposition figures had been plotting to seize power. Now, those claims, those charges are political charges. Basically, anyone who is in opposition to Alexander Lukashenko, many, many people, hundreds and hundreds of people have been rounded up and arrested since a huge wave of protests against the president back in 2020. So the release of one man is confirmed. We know that there are possibly 5 people in total who've been released so far, maybe 6. But as I say, their names haven't yet been released. And this was announced by Alexander Lukashenko in advance. He told people not to be surprised if some political prisoners were released when he announced a giant amnesty of prisoners generally. He said this was a humane act, he was claiming, because the people he planned to release are seriously ill. And that includes Mr. Kostusyov, who has cancer. He discovered when he was in prison that he had cancer. And I believe he's actually extremely sick.
And when we talk about jailed dissidents, what sorts of people are we actually talking about?
Well, in many cases, we're talking about journalists, analysts, experts, just regular people who have held a blog, who've stood up in a protest, people who are known to be associated with leaders of the opposition or members of the opposition, people who took part in or have been somehow linked to those massive opposition protests in 2020. It is just ordinary people who've dared to speak out, or in some cases haven't even spoken out, but have been sort of pointed to as opposition figures, people who are opposed to the authoritarian rule of Alexander Lukashenko. Many of them are now in exile, but 1,400 are in prison, and some of the most famous names among them have been held incommunicado for months and months. No word of them at all, no visits, no idea how they are. So there's a famous people like Maria Kolesnikova, who became extremely well known in Belarus when she led the opposition protests in 2020.
Sarah Rainsford. A new law banning the traditional practice of child marriage in Sierra Leone has been signed by President Julius Maada Bio. It means anyone involved in arranging the marriage of girls under 18 could get 15 years in jail and/or a hefty fine. Although the number of child marriages has dropped slightly in recent years, it's still widespread, with 30% of girls married before the age of 18 and 9% before the age of 15. Rebecca Kesby spoke to the First Lady of Sierra Leone, Fatima Bio.
The enactment of this bill is well overdue because it is a personal battle for myself. I was a victim. I was married off when I was 12 years old. Unfortunately, due to the war, the person I was married off to was not able to have me and taking over my life. But I knew I was married off. I knew they were waiting for me to just do my GCSE. And then I was going to go and be with this man who was 20, 25 years older than me. I lived with that experience all my life. And every time I see a child go through something like that, I knew exactly what they're going through. You have no hope.
I don't know if it's possible to describe that feeling. So knowing at the age of 12 the name of the man you're supposed to marry, who you probably have nothing in common with, him being so much older than you, what sort of impact does that have on you psychologically?
It breaks you completely. You have no hope for anything. You don't even enjoy your education anymore because you know that your education is not going to benefit you. So for me, that is like taking away a child's dream and destroy them even before they knew who they are. Mm. And that is an abuse that no one can repair. I still hate my immediate family for trying to do that. You continue to breed a cycle of children who will not be educated, who will not be empowered, who cannot contribute to nation building, and they become liability to themselves, to their family, and to the nation.
Fatima Bio, the First Lady of Sierra Leone. Now, we hear a lot about AI, or artificial intelligence, and its possible impact. Now it seems that the global greenhouse gas emissions of the US technology giant Google were nearly 50% higher last year than in 2019. That's because of the increasing amounts of energy needed by its computer servers, fueled by the explosive growth of artificial intelligence. This will make achieving so-called net zero emissions by 2030 significantly more difficult. So why does AI require so much more computer power and electricity? A question for our technology reporter, Chris Vallance.
There are lots of different kinds of AI, and some AI doesn't require much electricity at all, like the kind you might have in the most modern sort of smartphones. But when you talk about things like the kind of chat programs, the generative AI programs that are, you know, image creators, video creators, the chat programs that have really taken off in the past, you know, couple of years, those are based on an awful lot of computing power. You know, warehouses full of computing, effectively. And like your computer at home, they need energy to run, and they also need energy to help keep them cool, because like computers at home, they get hot when they're running as well. And I don't know if you've ever been inside one of these data centers, the cooling, the air conditioning is kind of, it sounds like a bit of a hurricane, you know, it's really loud. There's a lot of effort going on there. And so, you know, you see the energy consumption rise, and of course that has an impact on emissions, and that's difficult for these companies. I mean, Google, for example, has a net zero emission target by 2030, and a similar kind of target to reduce the absolute amount of emissions as well by nearly 50%. So that makes that much, much harder, because, of course, all these companies are racing to jump on the AI bandwagon. Clearly, there's a huge business case for doing it. And so, you know, they're sort of there's push and pull there. You know, on the one hand, they're making serious efforts to reduce their emissions. On the other hand, there's a business imperative to adopt AI and to push for AI innovation.
So does it really boil down to a choice between reducing emissions and increasing AI research?
Well, I think that Google would argue not. I mean, firstly, they'll point to the big use of renewables. And secondly, they'll point to increasing efficiencies of the chips and the technology. And thirdly, I think they'd point to AI being used to develop technologies and innovation that reduce carbon emissions. So, I mean, the kind of things they talk about in their environmental report is technology that times traffic lights, for example, so that you reduce the stop-start of traffic, and that being based on AI. And they'll also talk about, you know, route planning and more efficient route planning. And also, you know, we've seen advances in sort of technology that will reduce energy consumption of the tech and better design of chips and software that has also come out of AI.
Does it look like this is going to, although it's a fairly eye-catching headline,
does it look like this is going to be a temporary blip as we sort of get into a more AI world?
I think that depends on your definition of temporary, really. I mean, there are promising technologies on the horizon, but also, you know, there are some pretty blunt calculations out there. I mean, if you look at, for example, the sales of the most popular AI chips and then do the maths of, well, if they all sold, how much energy would that take up? You come up with some pretty big numbers. So I think we're kind of at the frontier of AI technology. People talk about artificial general intelligence, which is more human-like AI.
That was Chris Vallance. Some cycling news now. The British sprint champion Mark Cavendish has won the fifth stage of this year's Tour de France, securing victory with a powerful late finish. He said the Tour de France had changed his life.
This race definitely has given me the life and the career I had. I've always shown it the respect it deserves. We all know that it's bigger than a bike race, the Tour de France, and grew up dreaming of riding it. Grew a bit older and dreamed of riding it, winning here. And then I dreamed of winning more and more.
But the win isn't just another stage of a famous race. Our reporter Pierre Vickery explained why Wednesday's victory was such a big deal.
Let me give you a little bit of context. Eddie Merckx, 1975, he wins his 34th victory in the Tour de France. It's a win, everybody says it'll never be beaten. 2021, Mark Cavendish equals that record, and he's gone one better, and he is now on his own the all-time cycling champion from the Tour de France. So it's a very exciting day, and it's also the way he did it. You could just see, I was watching the last few meters of that race as he carefully navigated his way through his competitors, and when he put the afterburners on, there was only ever going to be one winner. And what's so nice about this story is that even his opponents were happy to cheer him on. The whole of cycling is so excited by today's big victory. Let me quickly give you a touch of context, because what's so important about this story, you might say, I don't follow cycling, why should I care? It's really a story about the human condition. When he did his 34th victory in 21, everybody said, oh, the next one will be soon. But no, it wasn't. He was brought down. He broke a collarbone. And even earlier this week, in the first stage of this year's race, he was all by himself at the back. He came in 40 minutes after all the others, and he was within a whisker of being thrown out of the race for missing the cutoff. So here he is. One day he's right at the back, and then here we are today with him all at the front. Couldn't be further forward if he tried. And I think that is what people will remember. A nice guy who wins. Who can't like that story?
That was Pierre Vickery. Scientists believe they have found the oldest example of representational art in a cave on the Indonesian island of South Sulawesi. The Australian and Indonesian researchers say the wall painting of a pig and three human-like figures is more than 51,000 years old. That's 5,000 years older than the cave art previously thought to be the oldest. Their findings have been published in the journal Nature. Our science correspondent Pallab Ghosh reports.
The discovery is important because it pushes back the time that modern humans first showed the ability for creative thought. The painting shows a pig standing with its mouth partly open, with at least three other human-like figures interacting with it. The largest of them has both arms extended and appears to be holding a rod, possibly a spear. The second is immediately in front of the pig, with its head next to its snout. It also seems to be holding a stick, one end of which may be in contact with the pig's throat. And the final figure seems to be upside down, with its legs facing up and splayed outwards. It has one hand reaching towards and seemingly touching the pig's head. Professor Maxime Aubert of Griffith University in Queensland says the discovery will change the ideas of human evolution.
It's a complex scene. We have a large animal, in this case a pig, and then you have human-like figures that are playing with it. So it is the oldest evidence that shows that human at the time had the capacity of thinking in abstract terms also and thinking in terms of storytelling.
Representational cave paintings have been found across the world. The big question is whether that ability first emerged in Africa, where modern humans evolved, and spread when our species left the continent 60,000 years ago, or it emerged independently later as there became a greater social need for recorded communication.
That was Pallab Ghosh, and if you want to take a look at those paintings, I will share a link on social media. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Wayne Moses. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.